The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, this is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. Does this world today make any sense? Where are all these events taking us? Where are we headed? Did you ever wonder how it's all going to come out? On the one hand, startling predictions of science and industry, instantaneous opinion sampling worldwide, controlled weather, great abundance, plastic organs, space travel, and all the rest of it. And yet all the predictions you hear of the glowing Disneyland, of the glittering glamour of the world to come, seems to totally ignore what happens in Vietnam. What happens in the Jew-Arab conflict? What about a divided Germany? What about South America? What about Africa? What about starving thousands and millions and food riots in India? These questions are either conveniently ignored or glossed over very rapidly. A few of us are told in the midst of this island of plenty that perhaps we're going to have even greater leisure, greater technology, greater pleasures, greater abundance of everything, of goods and services of all kind in the future. And yet the question is, will we survive? Can you expect any such thing as a practical outcome to today's world problems? Will it happen? And is there any way you can know it's going to happen? There is a source to which you can go that analyzes all the conditions of today, that gives you the entire panorama of life the way people are living it, and that admits all the problems are here, and tells the solutions to every one of them. A source that ignores none of the difficulties, none of the seemingly insoluble problems, and yet gives predictions about a world tomorrow beyond the wildest imaginings of science and industry. Instead of saying you're going to have plastic organs, it tells you you can keep your own. Now, the only trouble is, of course, that source would be rejected almost immediately by most people because it's embarrassing to them. The minute you say the word Bible, people have immediately a lot of opinions about it, but they've never read very much of it. They don't know much about it. As a matter of fact, it's almost a status symbol today to claim you know nothing about the Bible. It's becoming so among church-going Christian people who go to church once a week or at least several times a year. To say, well, of course I don't know very much about the Bible. Of course they have very concrete opinions about the Bible. Matter of fact, you can discuss a little bit about religion, especially if you seem to know what you're talking about, and you do get a little bit dogmatic about it, and you say, well, now the Bible does say this, and it does exactly contradict what you might think. And people can get very glandularly involved in all kinds of controversy. Yet they may literally know nothing about the Bible. I've got a few points to prove that to you. From Newsweek magazine, a survey of 1,600 parishioners in a fashionable Chicago suburb attempted to find out what the congregation really expected to get out of religion. Just what good did their religion do them? Now, the results were rather shocking. 72% of those replying said they were either somewhat confused or doubtful about their Christian faith. 34% of the adults said they went to church only to set a good example for their children. And a church official said this study shows their lack of understanding about what it means to be a Christian. Now, from the Vancouver Sun, an article entitled No Need to Prove God, which was written by clerics, they said you can't prove God's existence because this is something beyond man's reasoning power. And belief comes through faith. Now, are you like a lot of people who have begun to let other people do your thinking for you? Are you pretty well convinced there are no absolutes? And the only possible way you can discover any truth is at the end of an abysmally difficult labyrinth of self-contradictory, conflicting absolutes or completely irrelevant and technical detail. You can never discover the real truth. You can never discover the outcome. You can never come up with any concrete answers because it's simply unobtainable. They tell you all you can come up with is bigger questions, greater doubts, instead of really finding the answers. And so most people simply don't research on their own. They don't look up any basic facts for themselves. Reference books, almanacs, encyclopedias, dictionaries, public libraries go unused. Their sources of information practically untapped because people simply are not looking things up for themselves. They're not willing to prove it one way or the other. Now, a noted Bible translator, J.B. Phillips, has observed, it is one of the curious phenomena of modern times that it is considered perfectly respectable to be abysmally ignorant of the Christian faith. So when I say the Bible talks about present-day conditions, that it literally mentions the big powers of today and identifies them by their ancient names, tells you about the big alliances and power blocks emerging right now, talks about the economics, talks about governments, talks about military movements, talks about the religions of our day and of the near future. The average person is going to say, oh, come on, tell me another one. The average person simply won't believe that. Now, why? Not because they have carefully perused the Bible, researched it, looked through it, read it. Not because they have studied it and found it doesn't say anything of the kind, but because they haven't studied it and they have assumed it doesn't say anything of the kind. The evidence of biblical illiteracy is seen in a test given to 150 freshmen in a church college. Now, these were students who were studying, many of them toward the ministry. All of these students were members of a church and had never known a single day of their lives without religious influence of some kind or another. And the test in no sense indicated how a student would interpret the Bible. It dealt just with elementary questions about the Bible, such as, where was Jesus born? What was the earliest one of the books of the Bible, of the four Gospels? Name some of the letters of the Apostle Paul. Who was the successor to Moses? What book tells the history of the early church? And the answers were very revealing. Here are some of them. The story of Abraham, said some of these students, was found in the book of Ruth. The Roman persecutions were the great event of the Old Testament. The Exodus was the return of the Jews to Palestine after World War II. Apparently they'd seen the same movie a lot of you saw and read the book. The Ten Commandments were given by Jesus from the Mount of Olives. That'd be a good one. A lot of ministers would disagree with that, though, to say that Jesus gave the Ten Commandments from the Mount of Olives. Most ministers, I think, today think Jesus did the exact opposite, that on the Mount of Olives he completely did away with the Ten Commandments. They're not quite sure which mountain, but at least they've heard something about a sermon on a mount, which, if you look into it, was not a sermon, but private discussion with his own disciples, just a private conversation. Now, they thought, some of them, listen to this, that Jesus was born in Rome. And some of them said his mother's name was Gabriel, and he was baptized at Pentecost by John the Baptist in the Red Sea. At Pentecost in the Red Sea. And these people had been subjected to, or maybe that's the right word to use, maybe exposed is better, to religious education of one sort or another, at least influence, all of their lives. They said Moses turned the Red Sea blue during the Exodus. The mother-in-law of Ruth was Mary Magdalene, and Jesus was betrayed by Samson and died at Bethlehem. Now, the average grade of this test of 150 freshmen in a church college was 10%. That was the average. The highest mark in the whole class was 34 out of 100. Over half the students left three-quarters of the test unanswered, simply didn't know. And these results in no sense whatsoever reflect on the intellectual abilities. These kids might have been able to tell you a great deal about computers, about miniaturization, about space-age technology. They might have been able to quote Shakespeare and all kinds of literature, but what they knew about the Bible was a little bit pitiful. Now, the results do point to a crisis in the teaching of the Bible, but the point I want to make is people have very glandular opinions about the Bible, but they just will not look it up for themselves. So when I come on the air and say the World Tomorrow program tells you the meaning of today's world news in the light of Bible prophecy, and that the most accurate predictions, the most accurate analyses of present curves and trends and the outcome, where we're going, where we're headed, just what the world is going to be like in the next couple of decades, and that this is all found in the Bible. That sounds so incredible to most people, they would get a hoot and a holler and a huge laugh out of it. But it is a fact, and most people simply won't take the trouble to look it up for themselves. Bible prophecy does talk about our day. Few realize one full third of the Bible is prophecy. That Christ was a newscaster. That he plainly described the space age, this day of hydrogen weapons, this day of the proliferation of hydrogen weapons, for that matter. This time of the threat of human annihilation, the time of drought and famine and natural upset, and the threat of more calamities. That the big powers could be mentioned in the Bible by their ancient names, that the present alliances of today and the decay of others could be mentioned in the Bible, people either cannot or won't accept. Now, most people think the Bible is myth. They've never read it, but they think it is myth. They've got all kinds of ideas about Christ. They've never proved it, never studied it, but they suspicion that it may be. and they've been told by other people who are supposed to be authorities that you can't study the Bible for yourself. You're not intended to understand the Bible, people tell you. You're supposed to let the sky pilot, or the Holy Joe, as they used to say in the service, you're supposed to let him study the Bible, and then he sort of tells you what it means. And true enough, the average person looks into the Bible very superficially, and maybe by accident they turn to a genealogical chapter. And they see that so-and-so was the son of such-and-such, and they read a few of these difficult-to-pronounce names that sound rather strange, and they say, oh, that's enough for me. Or they turn, by accident, quite by caprice, to a prophetic section of the Bible, like maybe the book of Revelation. And they read about a many-headed beast with all kinds of horns. And they say, oh, ghastly, I can't understand that, so they quit right there. But, you know, you could take a simple test, and you could just open to the 5th chapter of the book of Matthew, and you could begin to read the focal point of all that is called Christianity, the Sermon on the Mount, and you would find in that so-called Sermon on the Mount a whole series of complete contradictions between what the Bible says and what you always thought it said. And you will find very quickly that there are many, many sections of the Bible that need no one to interpret them whatsoever, that you can understand very easily. But there is a key to Bible study and Bible understanding that most people have never discovered for themselves, and that is obedience. Wisdom begins with the fear of the eternal, with the proof that God exists and that the Bible is His Word, and a willingness to accept what it says without arguing with it. But it's a habit of most people to let other people do their thinking for them. Now, I can illustrate that point again, showing you how it's no different today from the time of Christ. During the time when Jesus was alive on the earth, all kinds of people had ideas about Christ, who he was, what his attitude was, what his message consisted of, what he was trying to do. Some thought he was a subversive. Even his own disciples weren't quite sure what he was getting at for a long time. They themselves misunderstood much of what he said, thought he was trying to set up a competing or conflicting kingdom of some kind. And as a matter of fact, at the very last moment of the recorded discussion between Christ and his disciples after his resurrection. If you can prove the resurrection to yourself, people claim to believe it, but do they prove it? They asked him, was he going to set up his kingdom at that time on this earth? And he had said time and again, no, my kingdom is not from hence. It's not for this time. My kingdom is not of this world. But they didn't get it. They didn't understand it. Now, people didn't get it either. Here in the 7th chapter of the book of John is a section about all the murmuring among people concerning him, because some said this and some said that, and the point is that other people believed them. Hitler claimed if you'd tell a big enough lie often enough, almost everybody would believe it. Now, most people don't just deliberately lie. Of course, a lot of people do. And you look at some claims involving products and other claims involving automobiles and claims involving people and athletic prowess and so on, and you wonder whether some people don't make either a habit or a hobby out of lying. But these people weren't lying. They were just doing what a lot of people do, just a lot of chatting, a lot of chit-chat, and a lot of pleasant conversation about Christ. So there was a lot of murmuring among the people concerning him. You read in verse 12 of the 7th chapter of John, and some said, he is a good man. Others said, no, he deceives the people. Now, there was information available to these people. The prophecies of Isaiah were available. No, they weren't in every home. They would have had to have gone to a leading synagogue, perhaps, and gotten copies. They would have had to ask someone, could they please look it up for themselves. But the point is, most of them have had a certain amount of religious education, and certainly there were those available who could have read it to them if they were illiterate. They could have read what it said in Daniel, what it said back in the writings of Moses, what it said in the writings of Isaiah, about what approximate time would Christ come. Where would he be born? What about his childhood? Would there be a fleeing into Egypt? Would there be any attempt on the part of a ruler of the day to kill a lot of children? What would people say about him? What about John? Would there have been some preacher as a forerunner to prepare the way for his coming? What about his message? What would he be called? What would be his very name? You know, every bit of that was predicted. Where he would be born, his message, everything about him was predictive. They could have proved it to themselves if they wanted to get the proof, but they didn't bother. They simply said, I think this or I think that. And other people, of course, believed them. Over in the book of Matthew, in the 16th chapter of the book of Matthew, is another statement, just along the same line.
people said this and people said that. And he began to get a little wild in these speculations. Here in the 16th chapter of Matthew and in verse 13, Jesus went down to Caesarea Philippi and he wanted to find out, well, what's the popular opinion? What's the public opinion say about me? So he asked his disciples, who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? Now here's the point. You know who you are, and I know who I am. And I know what I believe, I know exactly what I think and say and do, and you know all of this about yourself. But you don't know very much about some of the public officials, people who are running for office. You know what they say. And so you ask other people, what do you think about old so-and-so who's running for the office of such-and-such? And they say, ah, I think he's this or that. So this is a part of your store of knowledge, better put the word knowledge in quotes, about what you know or feel you know about this person. It was no different then. They said, verse 14, some say that you are John the Baptist. But the point is, if some said that, then others believed it. So there were a group of people who went around saying, Jesus, oh, he's not Jesus, that's John the Baptist and nothing else. Others said Elijah, that he is Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. So they thought maybe he'd come back, had been resurrected and was walking around and preaching and teaching. Maybe he was Isaiah or Elijah, Jeremiah, Jonah, or somebody else. Were they right? No, they were in complete abysmal error, but it was enough to satisfy them. And he said, but who do you say that I am? And then Peter gave the answer that led to the statement that has become so famous about the building of the church and about the gates of Hades, meaning the grave, would not prevail against it, but that it would continue. This has happened all the way through the historical sections of the Bible. Here was Amos, back in the book of Amos, in the 7th chapter, and he was a young herdsman. He had been directly called of God for a great commission, but Amaziah, the priest, sent to Jeroboam and said that Amos was guilty of conspiracy. Now, they said he was a complete heretic, and furthermore, he was plotting the overthrow of the government. Here was old Amos. He didn't know what to make of it. No servant of God throughout the entirety of the history of the Bible ever volunteered. Moses claimed he stuttered too much. Jeremiah said he was too young. Isaiah said, I'm a man of unclean lips. The Apostle Paul, or Saul as he was previously, tried to kill and did Christians. Christ called his own disciples. They didn't choose themselves. Not a one of these men sought to exalt himself. Every last one of them argued that he wasn't worthy. And, of course, Jonah tried to run away. And in each case, God made them carry a message. Now, behind the scenes, if you read the Bible and believe it today, you know this is true if you prove God exists and the Bible is His Word. So now today, you, looking back in retrospect in history, can know that Amos and others like him were sincere. They really had a message to convey that came to them from a completely superhuman and spiritual outside source. And they felt a real burden, as it says in the Bible, to get that message, oftentimes a warning message about the trend of the nation, about the way people were living their lives, about divorce, about crime, about the weather, about the government of the nation. And they wanted to warn about the trends, the direction in which the country was going, in order that the country could change that direction and not have to go into some kind of a captivity or some great economic debacle of some type. But their motives were always misunderstood. So Amaziah claimed to the king that Amos was a conspirator. And he said, the land is not able to hear all his words or bear all of his words. We can't stand it anymore because Amos says, and then of course he began to get right where it hurts to the king. He said, Jeroboam shall die by the sword, and Israel shall surely be led away captive out of their own land. Also Amaziah said to Amos, O thou seer, go, flee you into the land of Judah, and there eat bread, and prophesy there. And don't prophesy again anymore at Bethel. Now, isn't that human nature for you? He said, look, friend, why don't you get out of here and take that weird message of yours of the threat to the royal house and of the violent overthrow of this government and go down and preach it someplace else where people want to listen. Will you please get out of here? That's what he told Amos. Well, here was Amos's answer. He said, look, in verse 14 of chapter 7 of the book of Amos in the Old Testament, I was no prophet, and I wasn't a prophet's son. In other words, he said, I didn't choose this job for myself. I didn't decide to become a minister or a prophet. I didn't go to college to become a minister. I was an herdman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit, and the Eternal took me as I followed the flock, and the Eternal said unto me, go prophesy unto my people Israel. Now, therefore, hear the word of the Eternal. You tell me, don't prophesy, and drop not your word against the house of Isaac. Well, you can read the rest of what he said. He said, your wife is going to become a harlot in the city. It's going to get so bad in the siege. Your sons and daughters are going to fall by the sword. That was no personal animosity on the part of Amos. It was just a reaffirmation of the message he had been preaching all along, that it's going to come to pass just as I have said it would. And your land shall be divided by line, and you shall die in a polluted land, and Israel shall surely go into captivity forth of his land. Now you look back in history, and here's the object lesson. Israel went into captivity. That person's wife became an harlot, and he died in a polluted land. It came to pass exactly as Amos said it would, not because Amos wanted it to. Amos had been himself commissioned divinely. He had been forced to carry that message, not because he wanted to and not because he volunteered. But what did people say about Amos? They said he's a subversive. Well, he's guilty of treason. He's an heretic. He's trying to plot the overthrow of the government merely because he told them the real truth about the way things were headed. He couldn't help himself. He didn't want the job. You know, you look back in the life of Moses, you can turn clear back to Exodus, the third chapter, and there's a humorous account here a little bit. Moses was accused of his own people of being someone guilty of self-exaltation, of setting himself up in some great office of one kind or another. And in the third chapter of the book of Exodus, you'll find how when Moses was actually being called, he said, well, now who am I that I should go and carry this message to the people of Israel? I'm nobody. In verse 11 of chapter 3, you'll read that. Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? And then God had to say, I will be with you. And later on had to send his brother along to do his talking for him because Moses couldn't talk clearly enough. He stuttered. Rather badly, apparently. But later on in the 16th chapter of the book of Numbers, you will find that after all the experience, now mind you what these people had seen. It's a fantastic history if you would read it. They had seen miracle after miracle. They had seen fantastic plagues come upon one of the greatest nations of the day. They had seen the sea divided. They'd walked through dry shod. They had seen this great tent being built, and then this great leaping pillar of flame over it at night, and the great pillar of smoke by day. They'd seen the waters of Meribah made sweet. They'd seen water come gushing out of a rock, quails by the millions produced out of nowhere. They had seen miracle after miracle, and there was nothing logical about a miracle. No way to explain it at all. They had seen the whole thing. Plus the actions of the Egyptians themselves in giving them the gold and the jewelry and everything else when they let them go. But finally it got to the point where Korah and certain others, a sort of a party, got together. And they decided Moses must have been guilty of exalting himself. So what was the word about Moses? All the public opinion involving who and what Moses was totally different from the truth. And people could have proved it because here was the object lesson. They could have asked themselves, now wait just a minute. Moses doesn't have power to make water come out of a rock. There must be somebody behind him. Moses doesn't have the power to make a snake out of a rod or to make a river dry up or to make a whole sea part. Moses doesn't have the power to keep that fire going all night over that tent. He just doesn't have that kind of power. But the human mind isn't often logical, you know, and so these people weren't too terribly logical either. Korah appealed to their vanity, and they gathered themselves. Verse 3. Now you hear of riots, you hear of mobs, and you hear of demonstrations all the time. Well, that's exactly what this was. It was an anti-government, an anti-governmental policy demonstration. But this happened to be the representative of the government of God, not of man. So let's see what happened in this demonstration. They said to Moses and Aaron, you take too much upon you, seeing everybody here is just as good as everybody else. They said, all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Eternal is among them. Then why do you lift yourselves up above the congregation of the Eternal? Now when Moses heard that, it says he fell on his face and he began to call out to God. Later on, a test was made. And he said in verse 29, all right, if all of these men die just like anybody else, if they live to old age and they die according to the same way that everybody else goes, then I'm not God's representative and God hasn't sent me. But if the Eternal makes a new thing and the earth opens her mouth and swallows them up and all that pertains to them and they go down quickly into a great abyss or a pit, the Hebrew word Sheol, which merely means the grave, then you shall understand that these men have provoked not me. It's not me. I'm not going to do it. But God Almighty is the one you're dealing with. Now, verse 31, it came to pass, as he had made an end of speaking all these words, the ground clave asunder that was beneath them, and opened up. They all went down, the house, the goods, the sheep, the cattle, Korah, and everybody else. Now, you can either believe that or not believe it, whatever appeals to you. The point is, have you ever proved that God exists and the Bible is his word? You don't need to believe this because I say it, but the point is it's in the Bible, and it does say it in the Bible, and here's the lesson. Later on, the Bible says in verse 41, the next day, all the children of Israel said this, Moses and Aaron have killed the people of the Eternal. Now, can you imagine anybody being that stupid to literally claim Moses, through some kind of a gimmick, brought about an earthquake, a giant crevasse, so that 16,000 people went down into a huge pit and the earth swallowed them up and they disappeared from the face of the earth, and that this was the test he made, and there was no explosion, just a great trembling of the earth, and they simply disappeared. And the people said, you, they pointed a finger at the object of their misaffection, which was Moses, the symbol of government. They said, you have destroyed the people of God. Well, isn't that just about the way of human nature? Here were people who had about the most proof you can ever give anybody. Daily miracles on schedule. That's what they lived with. Daily miracles on schedule. Fantastic. The very fact that their shoe leather didn't wear out. The very fact of the way they were fed every single day for 40 long years. Manna. They went around and picked it up. They could fry it. They could beat it, boil it, pummel it. They could make cakes out of it. They could eat it raw. And it was good. Day after day, daily miracles on schedule. Plenty of proof, plenty of truth. But they just let a lot of arguments. Chewing the rag, beating their gums, arguing, murmuring, mumbling, grumbling among themselves, and making up their own minds about who was what and what was who, and whether Moses and Aaron were really sincere, and whether they really were what they claimed to be. Well, they made a kind of a stupid mistake, didn't they? Now, you look into the facts of it, the history of it, and human nature hasn't changed, because this is the way people make up their minds involving very important issues at this moment. Whether it's a government official, somebody running for office, a policy of government, whether it's the weather, they want to beat their gums about the weather, whether especially it's the Bible. And the one area in which people will make up their minds more quickly, it seems, than any other, is the most important. Who am I? What am I? Where am I going? Why am I alive? Where am I headed? What is the outcome of world affairs? People say, well, I think, or I feel, or I'm coming to believe. Well, now, you can just check some of the sources if you want to take the trouble to write a simple letter. And here is a booklet that marches right on out into the future in step-by-step sequence and detail to show you what are the solutions to these problems, the good news beyond. The title of the booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. This booklet, more than anything else, tells you the exact reason for being for this radio program. People oftentimes wonder, well, what is this program? And what do they believe? And what do they stand for? And who's behind it? And who sponsors it? And just exactly what are they trying to get over? This booklet, more than any other piece of literature we could put in your hands, and it's all free, is going to tell you exactly what we believe, what we stand for, what we're trying to do, and here's the whole story of how it's going to come about. The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. Free of charge, no price, if you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. The address will be given again in just a moment, and so until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.